This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Culture Code, The Secrets of Highly Successful Groups by Daniel Coyle. Read for you by Will Damron. Culture, from the Latin cultus, which means care. Introduction. When 2 plus 2 equals 10. Let's start with a question, which might be the oldest question of all. Why do certain groups add up to be greater than the sum of their parts, while others add up to be less? A few years ago, the designer and engineer Peter Skillman held a competition to find out. Over several months, he assembled a series of four-person groups at Stanford, the University of California, the University of Tokyo, and several other places. He challenged each group to build the tallest possible structure using the following items: 20 pieces of uncooked spaghetti, 1 yard of transparent tape, 1 yard of string, 1 standard-size marshmallow. The contest had one rule: the marshmallow had to end up on top. The fascinating part of the experiment, however, had less to do with the task than with the participants. Some of the teams consisted of business school students. The others consisted of kindergartners. The business students got right to work. They began talking and thinking strategically. They examined the materials. They tossed ideas back and forth and asked thoughtful, savvy questions. They generated several options, then honed the most promising ideas. It was professional, rational, and intelligent. The process resulted in a decision to pursue one particular strategy. Then they divided up the tasks and started building. The kindergartners took a different approach. They did not strategize. They did not analyze or share experiences. They did not ask questions, propose options, or hone ideas. In fact, they barely talked at all. They stood very close to one another. Their interactions were not smooth or organized. They abruptly grabbed materials from one another and started building, following no plan or strategy. When they spoke in short bursts. Here! No, here! Their entire technique might be described as trying a bunch of stuff together. If you had to bet which of the teams would win, it would not be a difficult choice. You would bet on the business school students, because they possess the intelligence, skills, and experience to do a superior job. This is the way we normally think about group performance. We presume skilled individuals will combine to produce skilled performance in the same way we presume 2 plus 2 will combine to produce 4. Your bet would be wrong. In dozens of trials, kindergartners built structures that averaged 26 inches tall, while business school students built structures that averaged less than 10 inches. Teams of kindergartners also defeated teams of lawyers, who built towers that averaged 15 inches, as well as teams of CEOs, 22 inches. The result is hard to absorb because it feels like an illusion. We see smart, experienced business school students, and we find it difficult to imagine that they would combine to produce a poor performance. We see unsophisticated, inexperienced kindergartners, and we find it difficult to imagine that they would combine to produce a successful performance. But this illusion, like every illusion, happens because our instincts have led us to focus on the wrong details. We focus on what we can see, individual skills. But individual skills are not what matters. What matters is the interaction. The business school students appear to be collaborating, but in fact they are engaged in a process psychologists call status management. They are figuring out where they fit into the larger picture. Who is in charge? Is it okay to criticize someone's idea? What are the rules here? Their interactions appear smooth, but their underlying behavior is riddled with inefficiency, hesitation, and subtle competition. Instead of focusing on the task, they are navigating their uncertainty about one another. They spend so much time managing status that they fail to grasp the essence of the problem. The marshmallow is relatively heavy, and the spaghetti is hard to secure. As a result, their first efforts often collapse, and they run out of time. The actions of the kindergartners appear disorganized on the surface. But when you view them as a single entity, their behavior is efficient and effective. They are not competing for status. They stand shoulder to shoulder and work energetically together. They move quickly, spotting problems and offering help. They experiment, take risks, and notice outcomes, which guides them toward effective solutions. The kindergartners succeed not because they are smarter, but because they work together in a smarter way. They are tapping into a simple and powerful method in which a group of ordinary people can create a performance far beyond the sum of their parts. This book is the story of how that method works. Group culture is one of the most powerful forces on the planet. We sense its presence inside successful businesses, championship teams, and thriving families, and we sense when it's absent or toxic. We can measure its impact on the bottom line. A strong culture increases net income 765% over 10 years, according to a Harvard study of more than 200 companies. Yet the inner workings of culture remain mysterious. We all want strong culture in our organizations, communities, and families. We all know that it works. We just don't know quite how it works. The reason may be based in the way we think about culture. We tend to think about it as a group trait, like DNA. Strong, well-established cultures like those of Google, Disney, and the Navy SEALs feel so singular and distinctive that they seem fixed, somehow predestined. In this way of thinking, culture is a possession determined by fate. Some groups have the gift of strong culture, others don't. This book takes a different approach. I spent the last 4 years visiting and researching 8 of the world's most successful groups, including a special ops military unit, an inner-city school, a professional basketball team, a movie studio, a comedy troupe, a gang of jewel thieves, and others. I chose groups using the following qualifications. 1, they had performed in the top 1% of their domain for at least a decade, where applicable. 2, they had succeeded with a range of different personnel. 3, their culture had been admired by knowledgeable people across their industry and beyond. To help guard against selection bias, I also looked at many cultures that weren't so successful. I found that their cultures are created by a specific set of skills. These skills, which tap into the power of our social brains to create interactions exactly like the ones used by the kindergartners building the spaghetti tower, form the structure of this book. Skill 1, Build Safety, explores how signals of connection generate bonds of belonging and identity. Skill 2, Share Vulnerability, explains how habits of mutual risk drive trusting cooperation. Skill 3, Establish Purpose, tells how narratives create shared goals and values. The 3 skills work together from the bottom up, first building group connection and then channeling it into action. Each part of the book is structured like a tour. We'll first explore how each skill works, and then we'll go into the field to spend time with groups and leaders who use these methods every day. Each part will end with a collection of concrete suggestions on applying these skills to your group. In the following pages, we'll spend time inside some of the planet's top-performing cultures and see what makes them tick. We'll take a look inside the machinery of the brain and see how trust and belonging are built. Along the way, we'll see that being smart is overrated, that showing fallibility is crucial, and that being nice is not nearly as important as you might think. Above all, we'll see how leaders of high-performing cultures navigate the challenges of achieving excellence in a fast-changing world. While successful culture can look and feel like magic, The truth is that it's not. Culture is a set of living relationships working toward a shared goal. It's not something you are. It's something you do. Skill 1. Build safety. 1. The good apples. Meet Nick, a handsome, dark-haired man in his 20s, seated comfortably in a wood-paneled conference room in Seattle with three other people. To outward appearances, he is an ordinary participant in an ordinary meeting. This appearance, however, is deceiving. The other people in the room do not know it, but his mission is to sabotage the group's performance. Nick is the key element of an experiment being run by Will Phelps, who studies organizational behavior at the University of South Wales in Australia. Phelps has brought in Nick to portray three negative archetypes: the jerk, an aggressive, defiant deviant; the slacker, a withholder of effort; and the downer, a depressive Eeyore type. Nick plays these roles inside 40 four-person groups, tasked with constructing a marketing plan for a startup. In effect, Phelps injects him into the various groups the way a biologist might inject a virus into a body, to see how the system responds. Phelps calls it the bad apple experiment. Nick is really good at being bad. In almost every group, his behavior reduces the quality of the group's performance by 30 to 40%. The drop-off is consistent whether he plays the jerk, the slacker, or the downer. When Nick is the downer, everybody comes into the meeting really energized. He acts quiet and tired, and at some point puts his head down on his desk, Phelps says. And then as the time goes by, they all start to behave that way, tired and quiet and low energy. By the end, there are three others with their heads down on their desks like him, all with their arms folded. When Nick plays the slacker, a similar pattern occurs. The group quickly picks up on his vibe, Phelps says. They get done with the project very quickly, and they do a half-assed job. What's interesting, though, is that when you ask them about it afterward, they're very positive on the surface. They say, "We did a good job. We enjoyed it." But it isn't true. They'd picked up on the attitude that this project really didn't matter, that it wasn't worth their time or energy. I'd gone in expecting that someone in the group would get upset with the slacker or the downer, but nobody did. They were like, "Okay, if that's how it is, then we'll be slackers and downers too." Except for one group. It's the outlier group, Phelps says. They first came to my attention when Nick mentioned that there was one group that felt really different to him. This group performed well no matter what he did. Nick said it was mostly because of one guy. You can see this guy is causing Nick to get almost infuriated. His negative moves aren't working like they had in the other groups, because this guy could find a way to flip it and engage everyone and get people moving toward the goal. We'll call this person Jonathan. He is a thin, curly-haired young man with a quiet, steady voice and an easy smile. Despite the bad apple's efforts, Jonathan's group is attentive and energetic, and they produce high-quality results. The more fascinating part, from Phelps's view, is that at first glance, Jonathan doesn't seem to be doing anything at all. "A lot of it is really simple stuff that is almost invisible at first," Phelps says. Nick would start being a jerk, and Jonathan would lean forward, use body language, laugh, and smile, never in a contemptuous way, but in a way that takes the danger out of the room and diffuses the situation. It doesn't seem all that different at first. But when you look more closely, it causes some incredible things to happen. Over and over, Phelps examines the video of Jonathan's moves, analyzing them as if they were a tennis serve or a dance step. They follow a pattern. Nick behaves like a jerk, and Jonathan reacts instantly with warmth, deflecting the negativity and making a potentially unstable situation feel solid and safe. Then Jonathan pivots and asks a simple question that draws the others out, and he listens intently and responds. Energy levels increase, people open up and share ideas, building chains of insight and cooperation that move the group swiftly and steadily toward its goal. Basically, Jonathan makes it safe, then turns to the other people and asks, "Hey, what do you think of this?" Phelps says. Sometimes he even asks Nick questions like, "How would you do that?" Most of all, he radiates an idea that is something like, "Hey, this is all really comfortable and engaging, and I'm curious about what everybody else has to say." It was amazing how such simple, small behaviors kept everybody engaged and on task. Even Nick, almost against his will, found himself being helpful. The story of the good apples is surprising in two ways. First, we tend to think group performance depends on measurable abilities like intelligence, skill, and experience, not on a subtle pattern of small behaviors. Yet in this case, those small behaviors made all the difference. The second surprise is that Jonathan succeeds without taking any of the actions we normally associate with a strong leader. He doesn't take charge or tell anyone what to do. He doesn't strategize, motivate, or lay out a vision. He doesn't perform so much as create conditions for others to perform, constructing an environment whose key feature is crystal clear. We are solidly connected. Jonathan's group succeeds not because its members are smarter, but because they are safer. We don't normally think of safety as being so important. We consider safety to be the equivalent of an emotional weather system, noticeable but hardly a difference maker. But what we see here gives us a window into a powerful idea. Safety is not mere emotional weather, but rather the foundation on which strong culture is built. The deeper questions are, where does it come from? And how do you go about building it? When you ask people inside highly successful groups to describe their relationship with one another, they all tend to choose the same word. This word is not friends or team or tribe or any other equally plausible term. The word they use is family. What's more, they tend to describe the feeling of those relationships in the same way. Not coincidentally, many successful groups have adopted the use of family-esque identifiers. People who work at Pixar are Pixarians, and people who work at Google are Googlers. It's the same with Zappos, Zapponians, Kip, Kipsters, and others. I can't explain it, but things just feel right. I've actually tried to quit a couple times, but I keep coming back to it. There's no feeling like it. These guys are my brothers. Christopher Baldwin, U.S. Navy's SEAL Team 6. It's not rational. Nobody who's purely rational about it does the kinds of things that happen here. There's a teamwork that goes way beyond team and overlaps into the rest of people's lives. Joe Negron, KIPP Charter Schools. It's a rush, knowing that you can take a huge risk and these people will be there to support you no matter what. We are addicted to that feeling. Nate Dern, Upright Citizens Brigade Comedy Troupe. We are all about being a familial group because it allows you to take more risks, give each other permission, and have moments of vulnerability that you could never have in a more normal setting. Dwayne Bray, IDEO Design. When I visited these groups, I noticed a distinct pattern of interaction. The pattern was located not in the big things, but in little moments of social connection. These interactions were consistent whether the group was a military unit, or a movie studio, or an inner-city school. I made a list. Close physical proximity, often in circles. Profuse amounts of eye contact. Physical touch. Handshakes, fist bumps, hugs. Lots of short, energetic exchanges. No long speeches. High levels of mixing. Everyone talks to everyone. Few interruptions. Lots of questions. Intensive, active listening. Humor. Laughter. Small, attentive courtesies. Thank yous. Opening doors. Etc. One more thing. I found that spending time inside these groups was almost physically addictive. I would extend my reporting trips, inventing excuses to stick around for another day or two. I found myself daydreaming about changing occupations so I could apply for a job with them. There was something irresistible about being around these groups that made me crave more connection. The term we use to describe this kind of interaction is chemistry. When you encounter a group with good chemistry, you know it instantly. It's a paradoxical, powerful sensation, a combination of excitement and deep comfort that sparks mysteriously with certain special groups and not with others. There's no way to predict it or control it. Or is there? On the third floor of a shiny, modernistic building in Cambridge, Massachusetts, a group of scientists is obsessed with understanding the inner workings of group chemistry. The MIT Human Dynamics Lab is a humble set of offices surrounded by a riot of workshops and offices that contain, among other things, a British telephone booth, a mannequin wearing pants made of aluminum foil, and what appears to be a miniature roller coaster suspended from the ceiling. The lab is run by Alex Sandy Pentland, a soft-spoken computer science professor with bright eyes, a bushy gray beard, and the easygoing assuredness of a country doctor. Pentland started out his career studying satellite photos of beaver dens, establishing a research method that never really changed, using technology to reveal hidden patterns of behavior. "Human signaling looks like other animal signaling," Pentland says, as we sit down at a coffee table in his small, homey office. "You can measure interest levels, who the alpha is, who's cooperating, who's mimicking, who's in synchrony. We have these communication channels, and we do it without thinking about it. For instance, if I lean a few inches closer to you, we might begin mirroring." Pentland leans closer, raises his bushy eyebrows, and opens his eyes wider. "It's a little disconcerting when I find myself doing it too, almost against my will." He smiles reassuringly and leans back. "It only works if we're close enough to physically touch." Pentland introduces me to a scientist named Oren Lederman, who, as it happens, is in the midst of analyzing a group working on the spaghetti marshmallow challenge. We walk down the hall to Lederman's office to look at the video. The group consists of three engineers and a lawyer, and their tower is coming together nicely. "This group's performance is probably better than the MBAs, but not as good as the kindergartners," Lederman says. "They don't talk as much, which helps." This is not just Lederman's opinion, it is fact. As we speak, a river of data from the group's performance is rolling across his computer screen, including the percentage of time each person spends talking, the energy levels of their voices, their speaking rates, the smoothness of turn-taking, the number of interruptions, and the amount each person's vocal pattern mimics the others. Lederman has captured this data using a small red plastic device the size of a credit card that contains a microphone, GPS, and an array of other sensors. The device is called a sociometer. It samples the data 5 times per second and wirelessly streams it to a server, where it is rendered into a series of graphs. These graphs, Pentland informs me, are only the tip of the data iceberg. If they desire, Lederman and Pentland can equip the sociometers to capture proximity and the percentage of time each participant engages in face-to-face contact. All in all, it is the kind of real-time, deep-dive data that you could imagine being used to measure presidential polling results or a golf swing. But this is a different kind of game. The sociometer captures the proto-language that humans use to form safe connection. This language is made up of belonging cues. Belonging cues are behaviors that create safe connection in groups. They include, among others, proximity, eye contact, energy, mimicry, turn-taking, attention, body language, vocal pitch, consistency of emphasis, and whether everyone talks to everyone else in the group. Like any language, Belonging cues can't be reduced to an isolated moment, but rather consist of a steady pulse of interactions within a social relationship. Their function is to answer the ancient, ever-present questions glowing in our brains. Are we safe here? What's our future with these people? Are there dangers lurking? Modern society is an incredibly recent phenomenon, Pentland says. For hundreds of thousands of years, we needed ways to develop cohesion because we depended so much on each other. We used signals long before we used language, and our unconscious brains are incredibly attuned to certain types of behaviors. Belonging cues possess three basic qualities. 1. Energy. They invest in the exchange that is occurring. 2. Individualization. They treat the person as unique and valued. 3. Future orientation. They signal the relationship will continue. These cues add up to a message that can be described with a single phrase. You are safe here. They seek to notify our ever-vigilant brains that they can stop worrying about dangers and shift into connection mode, a condition called psychological safety. As humans, we are very good at reading cues. We are incredibly attentive to interpersonal phenomena, says Amy Edmondson, who studies psychological safety at Harvard. We have a place in our brain that's always worried about what people think of us, especially higher-ups. As far as our brain is concerned, if our social system rejects us, we could die. Given that our sense of danger is so natural and automatic, organizations have to do some pretty special things to overcome that natural trigger. The key to creating psychological safety, as Pentland and Edmondson emphasize, is to recognize how deeply obsessed our unconscious brains are with it. A mere hint of belonging is not enough. One or two signals are not enough. We are built to require lots of signaling over and over. This is why a sense of belonging is easy to destroy and hard to build. The dynamic evokes the words of Texas politician Sam Rayburn. Any jackass can kick down a barn, but it takes a good carpenter to build one. It's useful to look at the bad apple experiment in this light. Nick was able to disrupt the chemistry of the groups merely by sending a few cues of non-belonging. His behavior was a powerful signal to the group, "We are not safe," which immediately caused the group's performance to fall apart. Jonathan, on the other hand, delivered a steady pulse of subtle behaviors that signaled safety. He connected individually, listened intently, and signaled the importance of the relationship. He was a wellspring of belonging cues, and the group responded accordingly. In recent years, Pentland and his team have used sociometers to capture the interactions of hundreds of groups in post-op wards, call centers, banks, salary negotiations, and business pitch sessions. In each study, they discovered the same pattern. It's possible to predict performance by ignoring all the informational content in the exchange and focusing on a handful of belonging cues. For example, Pentland and Jared Kurhan used sociometers to analyze 46 simulated negotiations between pairs of business students who played the role of employee and boss. The task was to negotiate the terms for a new position, including salary, company car, vacation, and health benefits. Pentland and Kurhan found that the first 5 minutes of sociometric data strongly predicted the outcomes of the negotiations. In other words, the belonging cues sent in the initial moments of the interaction mattered more than anything they said. Another experiment analyzed a competition in which entrepreneurs pitched business ideas to a group of executives. Each participant presented their plan to the group. The group then selected and ranked the most promising plans for recommendation to an outside group of angel investors. Pentland found that the sociometers, which tracked only the cues exchanged by presenter and audience and ignored all the informational content, predicted the rankings with nearly perfect accuracy. In other words, the content of the pitch didn't matter as much as the set of cues with which the pitch was delivered and received. When the angel investors viewed the plans on paper, looking only at informational content and ignoring social signals, they ranked them very differently. The executives listening to the pitches thought they were evaluating the plans based on rational measures, such as, how original is this idea? How does it fit the current market? How well developed is this plan? Pentland wrote. While listening to the pitches, though, another part of their brain was registering other crucial information, such as, how much does this person believe in this idea? How confident are they when speaking? How determined are they to make this work? And the second set of information, information that the business executives didn't even know they were assessing, is what influenced their choice of business plans to the greatest degree. This is a different way of thinking about human beings, Pentland says. Individuals aren't really individuals. They're more like musicians in a jazz quartet, forming a web of unconscious actions and reactions to complement the others in the group. You don't look at the informational content of the messages. You look at patterns that show how the message is being sent. Those patterns contain many signals that tell us about the relationship and what's really going on beneath the surface. Overall, Pentland's studies show that team performance is driven by five measurable factors. 1. Everyone in the group talks and listens in roughly equal measure, keeping contributions short. 2. Members maintain high levels of eye contact, and their conversations and gestures are energetic. 3. Members communicate directly with one another, not just with the team leader. 4. Members carry on back-channel or side conversations within the team. 5. Members periodically break, go exploring outside the team, and bring information back to share with the others. These factors ignore every individual skill and attribute we associate with high-performing groups, and replace them with behaviors we would normally consider so primitive as to be trivial. And yet, when it comes to predicting team performance, Pentland and his colleagues have calculated nothing is more powerful. Collective intelligence is not that different in some ways than apes in a forest, Pentland says. One ape is enthusiastic, and that signal recruits others, and they jump in and start doing stuff together. That's the way group intelligence works, and this is what people don't get. Just hearing something said rarely results in a change in behavior. They're just words. When we see people in our peer group play with an idea, our behavior changes. That's how intelligence is created. That's how culture is created. They're just words. This is not how we normally think. Normally, we think words matter. We think that group performance correlates with its members' verbal intelligence and their ability to construct and communicate complex ideas. But that assumption is wrong. Words are noise. Group performance depends on behavior that communicates one powerful, overarching idea. We are safe and connected. 2. The billion-dollar day when nothing happened. In the early 2000s, some of the best minds in America were competing quietly in a race. The goal was to build a software engine that connected internet user searches with targeted advertisements, an esoteric-sounding task that would potentially unlock a multi-billion dollar market. The question was which company would win. The overwhelming favorite was Overture, a well-funded Los Angeles outfit led by a brilliant entrepreneur named Bill Gross. Gross had pioneered the field of internet advertising. He had invented the pay-per-click advertising model, written the code, and built Overture into a thriving business that was generating hundreds of millions of dollars in profits, as well as a recent initial public offering valued at $1 billion. In other words, the contest between Overture and its competitors appeared to be a profound mismatch. The market had placed a $1 billion bet on Overture, for the same reason that you would have bet on the MBA students to defeat the kindergartners in the Spaghetti Marshmallow Challenge, because Overture possessed the intelligence, experience, and resources to win. But Overture did not win. The winner of this race turned out to be a small, young company called Google. What's more, it's possible to isolate the moment that turned the race in its favor. On May 24, 2002, in Google's kitchen at 2400 Bayshore Parkway in Mountain View, California, Google founder Larry Page pinned a note to the wall. The note contained three words: "These ads suck." In the traditional business world, it was not considered normal to leave notes like this in the company kitchen. However, Page was not a traditional business person. For starters, he looked like a seventh grader, with large, watchful eyes, a bowl haircut, and a tendency to speak in abrupt machine gun bursts. His main leadership technique, if it could be called a technique, consisted of starting and sustaining big, energetic, no-holds-barred debates about how to build the best strategies, products, and ideas. To work at Google was to enter a giant, continuous wrestling match in which no person was considered above the fray. This approach extended to the raucous all-employee street hockey games in the parking lot. "No one held back when fighting the founders for the puck," recalled one player, and to the all-company Friday forums, where anyone could challenge the founders with any question under the sun, no matter how controversial, and vice versa. Like the hockey games, the Friday forums often turned into collision-filled affairs. On the day Page pinned his note to the kitchen wall, Google's competition with Overture was not going well. The project, which Google called the AdWords engine, was struggling to accomplish the basic task of matching search terms to appropriate ads. For example, if you typed in a search for a Kawasaki H1B motorcycle, you'd receive ads from lawyers offering help with your H1B foreign visa application. Precisely the kinds of failures that could doom the project. So Page printed out examples of these failures, scrawled his three-word verdict in capital letters, and pinned the whole mess to the kitchen bulletin board. Then he left. Jeff Dean was one of the last people in Google's office to see Page's note. A quiet, skinny engineer from Minnesota, Dean was in most ways Page's opposite: smiley, sociable, unfailingly polite, and known around the office for his love of cappuccinos. Dean had no immediate motive to care about the AdWords problem. He worked in search, which was a different area of the company, and he was more than busy navigating his own urgent problems. But at some point that Friday afternoon, Dean walked over to the kitchen to make a cappuccino and spotted Page's note. He flipped through the attached pages, and as he did, a thought flickered through his mind, a hazy memory of a similar problem he'd encountered a while back. Dean walked back to his desk and started trying to fix the AdWords engine. He did not ask permission or tell anyone. He simply dove in. On almost every level, his decision made no sense. He was ignoring the mountain of work on his desk in order to wrestle with a difficult problem that no one expected him to take on. He could have quit at any point, and no one would have known. But he did not quit. In fact, he came in on Saturday and worked on the AdWords problem for several hours. On Sunday night, he had dinner with his family and put his two young children to bed. Around 9 p.m., he drove back to the office, made another cappuccino, and worked through the night. At 5:05 a.m. on Monday, he sent out an email outlining a proposed fix. Then he drove home, climbed into bed, and went to sleep. It worked. Dean's fix unlocked the problem, instantly boosting the engine's accuracy scores by double digits. On the strength of that improvement, and subsequent others it inspired, AdWords swiftly came to dominate the pay-per-click market. Overture's effort, hamstrung by infighting and bureaucracy, faltered. In the year following Dean's fix, Google's profits went from $6 million to $99 million. By 2014, the AdWords engine was producing $160 million per day, and advertising was providing 90% of Google's revenues. The success of the AdWords engine, author Stephen Levy wrote, was sudden, transforming, decisive, and, for Google's investors and employees, glorious. It became the lifeblood of Google, funding every new idea and innovation the company conceived of thereafter. Yet, that was not the strange part of the story. Because inside Google, there remained one key person for whom this incident didn't mean much, for whom the events of that historic weekend registered so faintly that he barely remembered it. That person happened to be Jeff Dean. One day in 2013, Google advisor Jonathan Rosenberg approached Dean for a book he was co-writing about Google. Rosenberg wanted to get Dean's version of the story, so he started in. "I want to talk to you about the AdWords engine, Larry's note, the kitchen." Naturally expecting Dean to pick up on the cue and launch into a reminiscence. But Dean didn't do that. Instead, he just stared at Rosenberg with a pleasantly blank expression. Rosenberg, slightly confused, kept going, filling in detail after detail. Only then did Dean's face dawn with the light of recognition. "Oh, yeah." This is not the response you would expect Dean to have. It is roughly the equivalent of Michael Jordan forgetting that he won 6 NBA titles. But that was how Dean felt, and how he still feels today. "I mean, I remember that it happened," Dean told me. "But to be completely honest, it didn't register strongly in my memory because it didn't feel like that big of a deal. It didn't feel special or different. It was normal. That kind of thing happened all the time." It was normal. Google personnel were interacting exactly as the kindergartners in the Spaghetti Marshmallow Challenge interacted. They did not manage their status or worry about who was in charge. Their small building produced high levels of proximity and face-to-face interaction. Page's technique of igniting whole group debates around solving tough problems sent a powerful signal of identity and connection, as did the no-holds-barred hockey games and wide-open Friday forums. Everyone in the group talks and listens in roughly equal measure. They communicated in short, direct bursts. Members face one another, and their conversations and gestures are energetic. Google was a hothouse of belonging cues. Its people worked shoulder to shoulder and safely connected, immersed in their projects. Overture, despite its head start and their billion-dollar war chest, was handicapped by bureaucracy. Decision-making involved innumerable meetings and discussions about technical, tactical, and strategic matters. Everything had to be approved by multiple committees. Overture's belonging scores would likely have been low. "It was a clusterfuck," one employee told Wired magazine. Google didn't win because it was smarter. It won because it was safer. The Google overture pattern is not unique to them. In the 1990s, sociologists James Barron and Michael Hannon analyzed the founding cultures of nearly 200 technology startups in Silicon Valley. They found that most followed one of three basic models: the STAR model, the professional model, and the commitment model. The STAR model focused on finding and hiring the brightest people. The professional model focused on building the group around specific skill sets. The commitment model, on the other hand, focused on developing a group with shared values and strong emotional bonds. Of these, the commitment model consistently led to the highest rates of success. During the tech bubble burst of 2000, the startups that used the commitment model survived at a vastly higher rate than the other two models and achieved initial public offerings 3 times more often. Let's take a closer look at how belonging cues function in your brain. Say I give you a moderately tricky puzzle where the goal is to arrange colors and shapes on a map. You can work on it as long as you like. After explaining the task, I leave you to your work. 2 minutes later, I pop back in and hand you a slip of paper with a handwritten note. I tell you that the note is from a fellow participant named Steve, whom you've never met. Steve did the puzzle earlier and wanted to share a tip with you, I say. You read the tip and get back to work. And that's when everything changes. Without trying, you start working harder on the puzzle. Areas deep in your brain begin to light up. You are more motivated, twice as much. You work more than 50% longer, with significantly more energy and enjoyment. What's more, the glow endures. 2 weeks later, you are inclined to take on similar challenges. In essence, that slip of paper changes you into a smarter, more attuned version of yourself. Here's the thing. Steve's tip was not actually useful. It contained zero relevant information. All the changes in motivation and behavior you experienced afterward were due to the signal that you were connected to someone who cared about you. We get another example of how belonging cues work in an experiment that might be called, "Would you give a stranger your phone?" It consists of two scenarios and a question. Scenario 1. You are standing in the rain at a train station. A stranger approaches and politely says, "Can I borrow your cell phone?" Scenario 2. You are standing in the rain at a train station. A stranger approaches and politely says, "I'm so sorry about the rain. Can I borrow your cell phone?" Question. To which stranger are you more likely to respond? At first glance, there's not a lot of difference between the two scenarios. Both strangers are making an identical request that involves a significant leap of trust. Besides, the more important factor here would seem to have less to do with them than with you, namely your natural disposition toward handing a valuable possession to a stranger. All in all, a reasonable person might predict that the two approaches would yield roughly equal response rates. A reasonable person would be wrong. When Allison Wood Brooks of Harvard Business School performed the experiment, she discovered that the second scenario caused the response rate to jump 422%. Those six words, "I'm so sorry about the rain," transformed people's behavior. They functioned exactly the way Steve's tip did in the puzzle experiment. They were an unmistakable signal. This is a safe place to connect. You hand over your cell phone and create a connection without thinking. "These are massive effects," says Dr. Gregory Walton of Stanford, who performed the Steve's Tip experiment and others. "These are little cues that signal a relationship, and they totally transform the way people relate, how they feel, and how they behave." Here's a handy use of this effect. Thinking about your ancestors makes you smarter. A research team led by Peter Fisher found that spending a few minutes contemplating your family tree, as opposed to contemplating a friend or a shopping list or nothing at all, significantly boosted performance on tests of cognitive intelligence. Their hypothesis is that thinking about our connections to the group increases our feelings of autonomy and control. One of his most vivid examples of the power of belonging cues is a study by an Australian group that examined 772 patients who had been admitted to the hospital after a suicide attempt. In the months after their release, half received a series of postcards that read as follows. "Dear Blank, it has been a short time since you were here at Newcastle Mater Hospital, and we hope things are going well for you. If you wish to drop us a note, we would be happy to hear from you. Best wishes, Signature." Over the next 2 years, members of the group that received the postcards were readmitted at half the rate of the control group. "A small signal can have a huge effect," Walton says. "But the deeper thing to realize is that you can't just give a cue once. This is all about establishing relationships, conveying the fact that I'm interested in you, and that all the work we do together is in the context of that relationship. It's a narrative. You have to keep it going. It's not unlike a romantic relationship. How often do you tell your partner that you love them? It may be true, but it's still important to let them know, over and over. This idea that belonging needs to be continually refreshed and reinforced is worth dwelling on for a moment. If our brains processed safety logically, we would not need this steady reminding. But our brains did not emerge from millions of years of natural selection because they process safety logically. They emerged because they are obsessively on the lookout for danger. This obsession originates in a structure deep in the core of the brain. It's called the amygdala, and it's our primeval vigilance device, constantly scanning the environment. When we sense a threat, the amygdala pulls our alarm cord, setting off the fight-or-flight response that floods our body with stimulating hormones, and it shrinks our perceived world to a single question: what do I need to do to survive? Science has recently discovered, however, that the amygdala isn't just about responding to danger. It also plays a vital role in building social connections. It works like this. When you receive a belonging cue, the amygdala switches roles and starts to use its immense unconscious neural horsepower to build and sustain your social bonds. It tracks members of your group, tunes into their interactions, and sets the stage for meaningful engagement. In a heartbeat, it transforms from a growling guard dog into an energetic guide dog with a single-minded goal: to make sure you stay tightly connected with your people. On brain scans, this moment is vivid and unmistakable, as the amygdala lights up in an entirely different way. "The whole thing flips," says J. Van Bavel, social neuroscientist at New York University. The moment you're part of a group, the amygdala tunes in to who's in that group and starts intensely tracking them. Because these people are valuable to you. They were strangers before, but they're on your team now, and that changes the whole dynamic. It's such a powerful switch. It's a big top-down change, a total reconfiguration of the entire motivational and decision-making system. All this helps reveal a paradox about the way belonging works. Belonging feels like it happens from the inside out, but in fact, it happens from the outside in. Our social brains light up when they receive a steady accumulation of almost invisible cues. We are close, we are safe, we share a future. Here, then, is a model for understanding how belonging works. As a flame that needs to be continually fed by signals of safe connection. When Larry Page and Jeff Dean participated in the whole company challenges, the Anything Goes meetings, and the raucous hockey games, they were feeding that flame. When Jonathan protected the Bad Apple group from Nick's negative behavior, he was feeding that flame. When a stranger apologizes for the rain before asking to borrow your cell phone, she is feeding that flame. Cohesion happens not when members of a group are smarter, but when they are lit up by clear, steady signals of safe connection. This model helps us approach belonging less as a mystery of fate than as a process that can be understood and controlled. A good way to explore this process is by examining three situations where belonging formed despite overwhelming odds. The first involves soldiers in Flanders during the winter of 1914. The second involves office workers in Bangalore, India. The third involves what might be the worst culture on the planet. 3. The Christmas Truce, the One-Hour Experiment, and the Missileers. The Christmas Truce. Of all the difficult and dangerous battlefields in history, the Flanders trenches during the winter of 1914 might top the list. Military scholars tell us that this is due to the fact that World War I marked the historical intersection of modern weapons and medieval strategy. But in truth, it was mostly due to the mud. The Flanders trenches were located below sea level, dug out of greasy clay so waterlogged that a rainstorm could transform them into canals. They were cold and miserable, an ideal breeding ground for rats, fleas, disease and all manner of pestilence. The worst part, however, was the closeness of the enemy. Opposing troops were only a few hundred feet apart in many points, and occasionally much less. At one place near Vimy Ridge, two observation posts stood 7 meters apart. Grenades and artillery were a constant threat. A carelessly lit match was an invitation for a sniper's bullet. As future Prime Minister Harold Macmillan, then a lieutenant in the Grenadier Guards, wrote, "One can look for miles and see no human being, but in those miles of country lurk, it seems, thousands, even hundreds of thousands of men, planning against each other perpetually some new device of death. Never showing themselves, they launch at each other bullet, bomb, aerial torpedo, and shell." Beneath the mud resided deeper layers of historical hatred between the Allies and the Germans. English and French newspapers printed fervent myths about how German barbarians were melting down innocent victims to make soap. For their part, German schoolchildren were reciting Ernst Lissauer's Hymn of Hate, which was only slightly less subtle. "You we will hate with a lasting hate. We will never forego our hate. Hate by water and hate by land. Hate of the head and hate of the hand. Hate of the hammer and hate of the crown. Hate of 70 millions choking down. We love as one, we hate as one. We have one foe and one alone, England." The war began in August. As the weeks and months passed, the two sides systematically killed each other and were killed, the bodies strewn in the barbed wire of no man's land. As Christmas approached, voices in distant capitals argued for a temporary ceasefire. In Rome, Pope Benedict appealed for holiday peace. In Washington, D.C., a Senate resolution requested a 20-day break in the fighting. Military leaders on both sides swiftly deemed this idea impossible and informed their troops to expect surprise attacks on Christmas. Any soldier who attempted to create an illicit truce, they warned, would be court-martialed. Then, on Christmas Eve, something happened. It's difficult to determine precisely where it began, but it appeared to have been spontaneous, occurring independently at several places along the front. It started with songs. Some were Christmas carols, some were military songs. In most places, the singing went back and forth for a while, with each side applauding or jeering the other's renditions. Then something even stranger happened. The soldiers began to climb out of their trenches and approach each other in a friendly way. Outside a town called La Chapelle d'Armentières, English soldiers heard a German voice call out in English, "I am a lieutenant. Gentlemen, my life is in your hands, for I am out of my trench and walking toward you. Will one of your officers meet me halfway?" Rifleman Percy Jones figured it was a surprise attack. As he later wrote, "We commenced polishing up ammunition and rifles and getting all ready for speedy action. In fact, we were about to loose off a few rounds at the biggest light when words were heard, probably through a megaphone. Englishmen, Englishmen, don't shoot. You don't shoot, we don't shoot." Then followed a remark about Christmas. This was all very well, but we had heard so many yarns about German treachery that we kept a very sharp lookout. How it happened, I don't know, but shortly after this, our boys had lights out, and the enemy troops were busy singing each other's songs, punctuated with terrific salvos of applause. The scene from my sentry post was hardly creditable. Straight ahead were three large lights, with figures perfectly visible around them. The German trenches were illuminated with hundreds of little lights. Far away to the left, where our lines bent, a few lights showed our A Company trenches, where the men were thundering out "My Little Gray Home in the West." At the conclusion, the Saxons burst into loud cheers and obliged with some German tune. They also sang one of their national airs to the tune of "God Save the King." We replied with the Austrian hymn, at which the applause was terrific. Back at British High Command, Field Marshal Sir John French received puzzling reports that unarmed German soldiers were running from the German trenches across to ours, holding Christmas trees above their heads. French issued immediate orders to prevent any recurrence of such conduct and called the local commanders to strict account.